Well, thanks for giving up your evening to hear me address this question, does science contradict Christianity? And as you can guess, I'm going to argue no, because this is an event organised by a church, but I would once have argued yes. So when I was a first year undergraduate, or just before I began university to study science, I wrote a poem to express my contempt for Christianity. And it's quite a short poem, and it's not very good, because I was studying science rather than literature, but I can still remember it. And it went like this. Some folks seem to find it odd that people grow from tiny cells. Pathetic, those who think of God and still drop coins in wishing wells. There we are. That was my contribution to British poetry. But it summarises something of what I thought about Christianity. It must be that Christians don't understand even the basics of biology. They think it's a miracle when actually we know it's cell division. They must be superstitious on a level with somebody who throws money into a well and makes a wish and honestly expects tomorrow to turn out differently on the basis of that. Even though I knew that, of course, the council just comes along once a week and empties the well and the money goes straight into the coffers. Sure, people used to believe that we got ill because of demons and we got better because of miracles. But now we've come to understand about bacteria and viruses and helper T cells and the immune system. People used to think that it rained because God had a big watering can in the sky. But then we came to figure out evaporation and condensation and the water cycle. So surely nowadays, now that we've put people on the moon and we've sequenced the human DNA, surely it's time to throw off all of these prehistoric, pre-scientific fairy tale ideas. That's what I used to think. About 2 months after I wrote that poem, I became a Christian and everything in my life changed. It's a long story. But basically, I met some Christians at university who didn't fit my stereotype of Christians. I thought that Christians were basically gullible hypocrites. I never put it quite that rudely. But I thought they were gullible because I'd never heard a serious reason to believe it. And I thought they were hypocrites because, well, I read in the papers what the vicars got up to and the scandals in the church and people looking smart on Sundays but living the same as everyone else. But I met Christians at university who weren't like that. They weren't gullible. Some of them were much more intelligent than I was. And they had serious reasons for what they believed. And they weren't hypocrites either. They attempted to live out their lives shaped by the teaching of Jesus Christ. And it was very attractive. And I began to look into it. To cut a long story short, I became a Christian. But I was still a scientist. And there's the paradox, isn't there? Because that is the one thing that the Richard Dawkinses of the world tell you that you can't be. A both and. They say either you can be a serious scientist and be logical and rational, or if you prefer, you can take a flight of fancy into your imagination and believe in God and angels and that sort of thing. But you certainly can't combine the two, they say. It's got to be either or. Well, I became a both and. And actually, I was in good company. It turns out many of the great scientists of the past were also committed Christians. So people like Isaac Newton formulated the theory of gravity. Michael Faraday, who discovered electricity. Louis Pasteur, who discovered microbes, bacteria. James Clerk Maxwell, the physicist. Robert Boyle, who came up with the gas laws you had to learn if you did A-level chemistry. Charles Babbage, who built the first mechanical computer. Johannes Kepler, who did work on interplanetary motions. Some of the leading scientists in the 17th, 18th century were also committed Christians. And arguably, there was actually a connection between the two things. One eminent historian of science, Sir Alfred North Whitehead, argued that men became scientific because they looked for law in nature, and they looked for law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. Had people believed in those days, as some do today, that the world's entirely random and accidental, it's questionable whether they would have bothered to try and understand it rationally at all. It was the conviction that there was a rational mind behind the world that got people investigating it scientifically. Well, you might say, okay, but that was a long time ago. That was several hundred years ago. What about nowadays? We've made these great strides forward over the last century. When I became a Christian, I went to church in Cambridge my first Sunday, and I sat next to somebody who had a beard, and I thought, he's probably a professor, and he was. You know, beards in Cambridge, pretty good indication. And it turns out he was the professor of geophysics at the university. Meanwhile, my next door neighbour in Halls was studying geology. His supervisor was one professor, Simon Conway Morris, professor of paleontology, also a Christian. And that's curious, isn't it? Because people tell you that you can't believe the Bible because of the fossils. And yet Professor Conway Morris, Professor Bob White, know more about geology and dinosaurs than most people in the world. And somehow they managed to be both ands. What about genetics? What about evolutionary biology? One of my best friends is a senior lecturer in evolutionary biology at Queen Mary University and a member of our church. You may know the same year that Richard Dawkins published The God Delusion, Francis Collins, the director of the Human Genome Project, one of the most important international scientific discoveries over the last decade. He wrote his book, The Language of God, explaining his faith in Jesus Christ. Too many both ands. And I want to suggest this evening that is because there is no contradiction between Christianity and science at all. At least I don't know of one. What is science? Science is a methodology for exploring the world, whereby you observe the world, you formulate a hypothesis to describe what you've observed, and then you test that hypothesis by experiments. There's nothing about that methodology that means you have to be an atheist to use it. And in fact, the first people to use it weren't atheists at all. Nor do I know anything discovered using that methodology that contradicts with anything that I know of in the Christian faith. I just think that there isn't any conflict at all. You can push me on that, between those two things. But undoubtedly there is a conflict, and I think that the conflict that rages in the secular press, you remember the slogans on the side of buses, the programmes on Radio 4, actually the conflict is between two different philosophies, two different worldviews, two different faiths, if I can be provocative. Now, of course, Richard Dawkins would go berserk if I described his position as a faith, and yet it is curious, as you read a book like The God Delusion, just how many assertions he makes without empirical support for them. I cannot accept that, or I think that, or I believe that, such and such. In many ways, it is a creedal book, a collection of beliefs. And those beliefs of the atheist do contradict with the beliefs of the Christian. But I want to say it's cheating to assume that science belongs to the atheist. Science is just a set of tools that we can both use. And so what I want to do in the time we have is to set out the two philosophies and then do what any responsible scientist should do, that is to decide which one makes most sense of the available evidence. So here they are, the two. There are certainly philosophies other than these two. I'm not going to speak about Hinduism or Buddhism or Islam in the time that we have tonight, but these are two that often go head to head. So on the one hand, atheism, on the other hand, Christianity. So atheism or naturalism is the worldview or the belief system that says that matter and chance are all that there is. All there ever was, all there ever will be, is just matter and the laws of nature that describe its behaviour. So Bertrand Russell, the great British philosopher, he once said, "Mankind is nothing but a chance collocation of atoms on a minor speck of interstellar dust." Well, as a scientist, I accept his right to say we are made of atoms, and he's right to say that the Earth is not a particularly important heavenly body, cosmologically speaking, just quite a small planet and a small solar system in a vast galaxy. But I disagree with Bertrand Russell when he says that you are nothing but that. You see, for the atheist, there is no more than the matter and chance that describes you. In my own field of neuroscience, Sir Francis Crick, the Nobel laureate, he once said this: you, he puts it in inverted commas, he's not sure how much the concept of personhood really makes sense, but you, your joys, your sorrows, your personal ambitions and sense of free will are in fact no more than the behaviour of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. Again, as a scientist, I agree with him that your thoughts are bound up with the movement of electrons in your brain. But for Crick, you are nothing but that, no more than that, reducible to that. No transcendent purpose, no God, no ultimate future beyond the grave. And Christianity really does conflict with that. And rather than just giving you my own version of Christianity, I thought I would give you an excerpt from a speech that the Apostle Paul gave in Athens in the first century. Athens was the intellectual capital of the day. People used to gather to discuss the latest ideas. And in this particular conversation, Paul, one of Jesus' followers, gets speaking to some Epicurean philosophers. The Epicureans believed that human life was down to chance and that there was no survival beyond death. So in some ways, they were the equivalent of today's atheists. And this is how Paul explains the Christian message in contrast to that. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man. Nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all human beings life and breath and everything. Well, if you can see, just from those two opening sentences, that in some ways Christianity and atheism are the direct opposite of each other. Let me explain what I mean. If you said to an atheist, does God exist? They would say no, or they might say probably not, which is the recently trendy and more sophisticated way of saying no. But if you said to an atheist, does Christianity exist? They'd say, obviously it does. You know, I'm not ignorant of this global phenomenon whereby about 1 billion people believe this guy called Jesus Christ is God. But then you say, well, explain to me where Christianity came from. They'd say, of course. We came about by chance, and then we made up the idea of God. So there was a randomness produced a human being, and a human being's imagination produced God. And the Bible says it's exactly the opposite way round. There is a God, and his imagination, his creative intention, made human beings in a universe that he made. Two different worldviews that do conflict with each other, which one makes most sense of the evidence? I'm going to compare them in three ways, and then I'm done, and you're welcome to ask me any question. Firstly, which one makes most sense of design? Now, I'm aware that's a loaded and controversial word, because of course not everyone believes that the world is designed. But everyone at least accepts it looks as though it's designed. Sir Fred Hoyle, the astronomer, once said that he found the idea that life as we know it, you know, intelligent beings gathered together in a huge church built by human beings, able to understand language, self-aware and conscious, the idea of that emerging by chance from a primordial soup seemed to him astonishingly unlikely. And he said it's a bit like saying that a whirlwind passed through a junkyard and by chance left in its wake a fully assembled functioning 747 aircraft. I mean, it's sort of conceivable that it could happen. You know, all the parts just happen to blow together, and the rivets blow in, and the steering column blows into the right place, and etc., etc., and it works. But really, it's stretching the imagination to believe something like that. But of course, the atheist has already an answer. Natural selection, or evolution, is the one-word solution to all the problems of apparent design or complexity in the world. So Richard Dawkins, in his book The Blind Watchmaker, puts it this way. Design, again, air quotes, design is only apparent. We have a mechanism to account for it, natural selection, the blind, unconscious, automatic process, which we now know is the explanation for the existence of, and apparently purposeful form of all life, has no purpose in mind. It has no mind, no foresight, no vision, no sight at all. If it can be said to play the role of watchmaker in nature, it is that of the blind watchmaker. Hence the title of his book. In other words, design is just a trick played on you by an automatic, purposeless process. You think you were designed, but actually it was just accidental, and natural selection automatically produced the complexity that you attribute to design. Well, I want to disagree with that, and rather than getting into a debate about evolution, we could have that debate. I question whether there really is sufficient evidence that human beings' self-aware conscious minds came about from single-celled ancestors billions of years ago with nothing but time in between. And certainly that goes far, far beyond anything that's been demonstrated in the laboratory. But even if you accept that, even if you think that evolution will do everything for you, from a single-celled organism to a functioning human being, you've still got a problem. Because you can't even begin to have evolution unless you've got an organism able to pass on its genetic characteristics to its children. That's the minimum before you can even have natural selection. You can do it with DNA or perhaps by RNA. There are some RNA viruses that do that. And RNA is one of the most complicated molecules known to chemistry. So where does that come from? And where does the information come from on the first accidental string of RNA that encodes the proteins to build even the simplest cell capable of self-replication? You can't use the evolution argument to answer that, because you've got to have that in place even before you can have evolution. And it's not just having RNA that's a problem, you've also got to have a universe in which the RNA exists. And that's where the problems really begin to grow. The physicists tell us that the fine tuning necessary to have any kind of universe of the kind that we live in is astonishingly improbable. So for example, there's a whole load of examples I could give, but my favourite one is this. The Big Bang, just after the universe began, it expanded very rapidly. It's known as the view of inflation. But the expansion rate of the universe had to be exactly right. If it expanded too quickly, then there would be only hydrogen atoms with billions of miles between each one. You just have a very, very low density gas. There'd be no stars, no planets, no elements other than hydrogen, and certainly no human beings. On the other hand, if the Big Bang went bang too slowly, then gravity would get the better of it and suck it back again. So it'd go bam and gone, even before you got 1 millisecond on your stopwatch. To have any kind of universe with stuff more complicated than hydrogen that lasts for longer than a millisecond, the balance of expanding and contracting forces has got to be correct to within 1 part in 10 to the 55. This is not a very big number. If you're not a scientist, let me give you an analogy. Take a continent the size of America, cover it with 5 penny pieces, and stack them to a distance, to a depth of the distance between here and the moon, 380,000 kilometres away. And do the same for a billion, billion, billion continents the same size. Paint one of them red with nail varnish, blindfold your mum, get her to choose one at random. She gets the right one, that's about 1 in 10 to the 55. In other words, it is very, 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 very unlikely. Even more unlikely than winning the Euro Millions by about 10 to the 50 times. Now, the atheist knows about these numbers. This isn't a special Christian argument, by the way, with Christian numbers from Christian laboratories. This is mainstream science. But the atheist knows about this, so the recent comeback is to say, well, maybe there's a multiverse. Maybe there are infinitely many universes. Because if you roll the dice enough times, then eventually your number will come up. The multiverse is an interesting theory, isn't it? But it's not really a scientific theory. As the review in Nature, the scientific journal, pointed out, the multiverse is not an observable or a repeatable or a testable theory. It's just a theory that you can believe in if you prefer the idea to that of an intelligent God. But you've got to do something with the numbers. They're very unlikely. So if you want, by blind faith, you can believe in infinitely many universes. I'm not sure that's a better solution, personally, because it means that everything that happens in this universe also didn't happen in every possible permutation in one of the simultaneously occurring infinite number of universes. As well as the universe in which I finished this talk, there's the universe in which I drop dead now. No, we're not in that one. Sorry about that, if you were hoping that this would end soon. As well as the universe where you're sitting there, you'll switch the other way round, and then you'll switch the other way round, and one of you's got one extra nostril hair, and one less nostril hair, and in fact, every possible number of nostril hairs. And everything that's happening is also not happening in every perfectly infinite number of copies of the universe that are simultaneously existing. You know, if all I've got to go on is blind faith to believe that, I'm not really willing to. Seems to stretch me too much. The alternative is, there's a God who chose the numbers. He made the Big Bang go bang at the right speed. He put the necessary information into the first DNA or RNA molecule. He designed human beings in his image to be self-aware and conscious and capable of relationship. Seems to me that makes better sense of the numbers that the science gives us. Firstly, design. Secondly, which one makes most sense of human existence? John Gray was professor of European thought at the London School of Economics not a Christian, but he wrote a book called Straw Dogs, in which he chastised today's naturalists for failing to take their beliefs to their logical conclusion. In other words, he said, the trouble with these people is they're sort of hypocrites, because they say they believe something, but they don't follow it through. Now, I don't know about you, but that was one of the things I found most nauseating about religion as a teenager. I hated hypocrisy. And if you hate hypocrisy, you're in good company, because Jesus Christ couldn't stand it. But I'd never noticed as an atheist that I too was guilty of hypocrisy. See, I said that I believed that the world was only random, and I behaved as though I didn't believe that. John Gray says this. He says, "What man must accept that he is nothing more than a lucky throw in the cosmic lottery. He lives in a universe that is indifferent to his hopes, as to his sufferings and his crimes." In other words, random numbers don't care about ethics, and they don't care about suffering. What should a naturalist say to a mother who's just lost her teenage son? He was cycling home, and a car smashed into him, and then drove off, leaving the body to die in the ditch. That happened to my mum's friend, Jean. Her son, Gavin, was in my class at school. What should my mum have said to Jean? "Oh, Jean, unlucky. Just the way that the atoms of the universe bumped into one another billions of years after it began by chance." Now, of course, I suspect an atheist wouldn't say that. Rather, they'd say something like, "Well, I'm terribly sorry. I want to be compassionate to you." If pushed, they'd say, "Compassion's evolved. We've developed this social care for one another." But the trouble is, it boils down to something that doesn't care. Because sociology is just the behaviour of lots of brains in the same room. Therefore, sociology is reducible to neuroscience. Please have the neuroscience department have all of your budget. Thanks so much. But of course, neuroscience reduces to chemistry, because brains are just complicated collections of chemicals. So the chemistry department seizes all the budget. And then chemistry is reducible to physics, and so let's build another Hadron Collider and see if we can work it out. But the trouble is that what we think matters, sociology, reduces to something that doesn't care. Your brain is all it is a random collection of atoms, says the atheist. And atoms don't care. I had an argument once with one of the professors during my PhD. I said to her, we were good friends, but I said to her, for the sake of argument, "Kate, if you're right about the universe, why would killing you be wrong? Why would it be any different to cutting a grapefruit in half for my breakfast?" Please understand, this was just for the sake of argument. We were good friends. She thought about it. She said, "Well, my mother would be upset." I said, "Kate, what's upset?" "Upset is just the change in the concentration of a neurotransmitter in the randomly assembled collection of atoms, which is your mother's brain." You see, Kate didn't live as though that didn't matter. Neither did I. Neither do any of you. But there was a hypocrisy about it, I think. Whereas the Christian has no hypocrisy, because what the Christian believes about the world fits very well with how we intuitively live in the world. Human life matters. Good and evil are different to each other. Let me read to you how the Apostle Paul goes on in his speech. "God made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, in order that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way towards him and find him. Yet he's actually not far from each one of us." Now, that was an extraordinary thought for me as a non-Christian. If there was a God, I thought, then he's just an equation or a first cause, someone to make the Big Bang go bang. But the Bible is telling me that God actually was personal, and that he wanted to know us personally. Not just an equation, but a being capable of relationship. Which begins to explain why as human beings we think relationships are so important. But here's the problem. How do you get to know a God who you can't see or measure or touch in the laboratory? Now, I want to say something very important now. Please do take this away with you. Science is a very useful and powerful tool, but it cannot tell you everything that's important. It's not the only kind of data that is available. And in particular, science isn't very good at telling you about human beings. Well, it's not making it very things, actually. I remember I was talking to a friend last year, a physicist friend who's an atheist, and he said, I will only accept something that you can prove to me by scientific experiment. And I said that was a bit silly, because there were other sorts of knowledge other than scientific knowledge. He disagreed, and so he left. And then about an hour after we'd had lunch, I texted him saying, hey Alex, thanks for coming round for lunch. If indeed you did come round, I find that I'm unable to verify this empirically. That was a bit cheeky, wasn't it? But of course, we do have other ways of knowing things. And when it comes to getting to know people, science isn't always your first choice. Let's imagine you want to get to know me. Here I am. You can do whatever experiments you like. Well, what could you find out? You could do gas chromatography under my armpits. You could work out what deodorant I'm wearing and whether it's coping with a slightly intimidating situation, whether it copes in question time in a moment. You could do DNA fingerprinting. You could work out whether I'm wanted by Interpol or whether I'm likely to die prematurely of any known genetic illness. But that's about all that you could find out. You wouldn't be able to tell my name. You wouldn't be able to tell what's important to me, who I care about, what I would die for. In fact, almost anything of any importance to me as a person would be beyond the reach of your experiments. Which is why I very much doubt if any of you here is in a relationship, you began your first date by saying, please can I take a small sample from the inside of your cheek, I'll be running some tests, and I'll be back with a decision in a couple of weeks. It just doesn't work like that, does it? You get to know somebody, and it requires language and dialogue. But how do you do that with a God that you can't measure or see or test? If God's everywhere, how do you exclude him from the apparatus to take a null reading as a control? God, please could you leave for a moment? We'll compare the readings and see if they're any different. You can't do that kind of experiment. In fact, you'd be lost to know God unless he decided to make himself known. And the Bible says that's what he did extraordinarily 2,000 years ago. Jesus Christ, this man born in occupied Palestine in Israel in the first century, claimed to be the one who had made the universe, now become a human being in order to introduce himself. He validated that claim by extraordinary miracles. Now, I used to have a massive problem with the miracles in the Bible as an atheist, but now I realise I'd have more problems if there weren't any miracles. Let's imagine I said to you, oh, you're lucky to have me tonight at Euston Church because actually I'm God. I think you would be sceptical about that claim, particularly if I said, when you asked me to prove it, oh, I'm sorry, I'm not able to do anything that any of you can't do, but trust me, I'm God. Actually, a God who was unable to do anything unusual, I would find more suspicious. For Jesus to be able to mess with the laws of biology and physics are precisely the things that I would expect somebody in charge of the laws of biology and physics to be able to do. And supremely, the Bible says, this is the last line of Paul's speech, God commands people to change their minds about him, because he's fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he's appointed, and of this he's given proof to all by raising him from the dead. What a surprise that word was for me as an atheist in the Bible. See, I believe the Richard Dawkins line that science is about facts and reason, and religion is about imagination and faith and leaps in the dark. And here I was reading the Bible, and it said God wanted me to have evidence or proof. And the evidence he'd given was by raising this man from the dead. I suggest that's pretty good evidence that you're dealing with not just a normal human being. Somebody who's dead and 3 days later can mess with the laws of biology sufficiently to return again. Now, in the God Delusion, Richard Dawkins mentions the resurrection of Jesus only to say that it cannot have happened, being by definition a violation of the laws of science. But actually at that point, Richard Dawkins has got the scientific method wrong. Because that's not how it works. You don't have a theory and then exclude the evidence that doesn't fit it. Rather, you take the problem evidence and go to revise your theory. What Richard Dawkins is really saying is the resurrection of Jesus can't have happened because I've already decided that there's no God, that the laws of nature are inviolable, that Jesus was just a con man if he existed at all. And given that, there cannot have been a resurrection. It's slightly circular, isn't it? Whereas if you are willing to even be open to the possibility of there being God, The sensible thing to do would be to look at the historical evidence and ask whether there could have been a resurrection. And if there was a resurrection, then you validated the idea there was a God who made the world. He's trying to get in touch. But that would require a paradigm shift. It's a shift that I made in 1994, probably the most important decision I ever made. I'd love to talk to you more about it and answer whatever questions you may have. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for the questions. And Andrew, thank you again for the talk. So here is the first question, a little bit of a cheeky one. Why is it that you can remember all the Dawkins quotes off by heart, but you need to pick up the Bible to know those quotes?
Thank you very much. That made me laugh. Fair enough. I think the answer is, I was always told that when you give a Christian talk, you should hold a Bible so that people can see that what you're saying actually is from the Bible. And if you have one in your hand, you can look as well. So it's sort of habit, but yeah.
Okay. You can say at the end whether you're convinced by that expression. If God made the Big Bang go bang at the right speed and made evolution occur with the right molecules, why is this not written in the Bible?
The Bible's not comprehensive about the mechanism of creation. It doesn't tell you anything about, you know, ears. I spent 3 years studying a particular element of ears. It's not in the Bible. You know, you can look at cosmology. It's not in the Bible. The Bible's not setting out to tell you everything it could say. So the question is what the Bible says is true rather than is what the Bible says all human knowledge? No one's pretending that it is. And probably, you know, if the Bible had told you about the Big Bang, people wouldn't have understood it for the first 2,000 years. And probably we wouldn't understand it either, because there's a lot of stuff that we haven't found out in science yet. So, you know, what level of explanation would God choose to tell you about? Some sort of math that hasn't been invented yet, and everyone think, what's that about? So, yeah, the Bible's not trying to be comprehensive, but I would say what it says about the world is true.
Thank you. Dinosaurs, question mark.
Are pretty amazing, aren't they? Yes. I probably do understand the question, but I just want to straight bat it and say, yeah, of course, dinosaurs are amazing. God made them, just like he made lots of other incredible creatures. Probably the questioner means, doesn't dinosaurs mean there are extinct previous evolutionary species? Yeah, okay. I don't see why that's a problem necessarily. So you can talk to me more about that afterwards, but I don't really see the issue. I go and see them in the Natural History Museum, same as you do.
Great, thank you. Now here's another one where people think there's an issue. How do we make sense of the age of the world, as science seems to suggest different from what the Bible says?
Okay, thank you. So some people think, some Christians think, and some people assume Christians think, that the world's only about 6,000 years old, and they get to that number by counting the days of Genesis chapter 1 as 24-hour periods, and then starting the clock from there. Personally, I don't think that's the way the Bible should be understood in Genesis chapter 1. I think that the idea of a day is a figurative motif to say that God made the world in an ordered way. One of the reasons I think that is because God doesn't make the sun until day 4, and my definition of a day is pretty much bound up with the sun being in one position as the earth turns on its axis. So I don't think it's trying to tell you time periods. You might say that's just a fudge because you realise you got it wrong and so you had to do a sort of post hoc adjustment of what the Bible means. To which I respond, interestingly, some of the early Christian scholars in the 3rd and 4th century, long, long, long before there were any ideas about evolution or geological time, thought that the days in Genesis chapter 1 were figurative. So it's partly just how do you understand this particular text. The Bible is full of different kinds of genres of literature, so it contains some poetry. There's a psalm in which King David says, I'm poured out like water. He's not describing a miracle whereby he becomes a fluid. He's just saying, I feel rubbish. And he describes that as being poured out. And the question is that the day like that, a sort of poetic device, or is it trying to be a literal time device? So Christians differ on it. Personally, I think the world's quite old, billions of years old, and God designed it that way. Other Christians would differ.
Thank you. is the only other possible option apart from evolution for the creation of man that they were formed from clay? Does it have to be either or?
Yeah, so as I say, I deliberately avoided evolution in my talk, and the reason for that is it's an issue that Christians differ on, and there are different views, and I also think it doesn't get us very far, so I've had endless debates about it, and they're never very profitable. So if you're asking the evolution question, I'm going to repeat my challenge to you. Evolution will do some of the work for you, but you can't have evolution unless you first have information-carrying self-replicating molecules and information. Where does that come from? And you can't have that unless you have a universe that is exactly tuned to the properties required to have such molecules. And I think that even that gives you enough of a problem to leave you scratching your head and going for a multiverse or something crazy. What's the question about evolution itself? Is the only possibility? The Bible's quite clear that God made human beings distinct from animals. And he used lots of the same templates, because human ears are similar to guinea pig ears or whatever. Human DNA is partly similar to chimpanzees' DNA. The similarities, we have eyes and noses and things. But human beings, says the Bible, are distinct because we're made with the capacity to relate to God in his image. And the Bible describes that as God making human beings in a wholly different way in terms of our spirits and our ability to relate to him than the rest of the animals. Now, how he did that, the Bible doesn't go into. Whether he used templates that he was also using to make other organisms, quite possible. But I would say, as a Christian, the distinct creation of human beings is a non-negotiable.
Thank you. Now, if there is indeed a designer, who designed the designer?
Yeah, nobody. Because the designer is eternal. Let me try and explain this, and do listen carefully, because I've discovered in some debates on this issue, even quite leading atheists misunderstanding this, and I find it very, very frustrating. So here's the argument. You have to explain in science something that is changed. So let's imagine, here we are now, and there's a microphone, and then suddenly there the microphone's over there. And you notice it's moved, and so the legitimate question is, how did the microphone move from there to there? And the answer in this case is, a human agent moved it with his muscles, etc. But I don't have to explain something that hasn't changed. So if I now say, why is the microphone still there? Still there because nothing's happened to it. So you have to explain changes. You don't have to explain static or ongoing situations. Now, people used to think that the universe was eternal, up to actually just about 100 years ago, that was the prevailing view. And if the universe has been eternal, then no one has to explain where it came from. It didn't come from anywhere, it's just always been there, like the microphone's always been there. But actually, recently, over the last 100 years, people have gravitated towards a Big Bang theory, and they think that the universe has a beginning in time. Well, if the universe began, then you've got to explain why. Because things that change have got to be explained. No universe to a universe requires an explanation. Whereas an eternal universe wouldn't have required an explanation. Well, the Bible says, quite simply, that there is an eternal God who made a finite universe. You don't have to explain God because he's always been there. So the question, people come back thinking they're being very clever, you know, who made the universe? God did. Ah, but who made God? The answer is nobody made God. God has never been made. He is eternal. And as such, you don't have to explain how he came into being, because he never did come into being. But the universe began, and the Christian explanation is because God decided to make it. And the atheist explanation is, I don't really know. I'm still waiting to hear one. Yeah.
Thank you. Hey guys, thanks for these. We're going to keep going for a few more minutes. These are great questions. Thank you, Andrew, for getting through them. Just give you a bit of a break. I hope you know the answer to this one easily. What was your full PhD title? do you remember it?
I do remember it. It's called Auditory Spatial Attention, and it was basically about how you select between simultaneously occurring sounds. So we talk about paying attention, sort of colloquially, but what is actually going on neurologically when you decide to focus on this sound rather than that sound? How do you do that inside your head? And what are the processes?
Cool. I don't know what the next clever question to ask about that is, so I'm not going to ask. This is quite an interesting one, Andrew. I'd like to say something about this because a couple of people asked me this. Basically, why did we not ask a non-Christian scientist and have a bit of a debate with Andrew? They liked your talk. It sounded convincing. I'd like to hear a non-Christian scientist respond to be able to compare. Why not? Maybe could you say what would be the most challenging comeback or something that someone might say to this that you'd have to stretch your brain cells?
I think my defence would be, we live in an increasingly secularist culture where most of what you hear is the non-Christian opinion about it. So I think, you know, I'd say an evening to give a comeback is a sort of fair ratio, really. Simply that. So you'll easily find the atheists, publications, the Richard Dawkins ones, etc. They predominate in much of the media.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, as a church, we'd love to do that. Maybe we could have you get you back, Andrew, and do a debate like that. Do you think a theological quandary would exist if intelligent life is discovered on another planet?
I don't think so. I mean, the Bible is deliberately human-centred, because it's addressed to human beings about what we need to know about the God who made us. So, you know, if God had decided to make some other creature in some other galaxy and speak to them in some way, then he's at liberty to do so. But certainly one of the most amazing things about this planet is that God decided to visit it in person and even to send his son to die to save and forgive people from here. So God, even though we're pretty small in cosmic terms, God cares a lot about what goes on in this little corner of the galaxy. But if he has other purposes elsewhere, then, you know, it's like those creatures that they see in the submarines that go down to the bottom of the Marianas Trench. I love that. You know, God presumably made them just because it was fun. You know, I mean, no one ever saw them for millions and millions of years. He can do things. Maybe he has made life elsewhere in the galaxy to entertain himself. But we need to know about what he says to us.
Thank you. Now, Andrew, there's quite a few questions about the reliability of the Bible. I guess particularly because you are someone who's clearly into evidence. Isn't this book scant evidence for a whole worldview? How, as a scientist, do you critically evaluate the Bible as a piece of evidence for there being a God? Several questions on that.
Yeah. I think it's good evidence, and we could talk about that for a whole evening. But as I said before, scientific evidence isn't the only kind of evidence that we use in life, and this isn't scientific evidence. This is not an experiment that you can repeat, so you can't, you know, sort of get Jesus to appear in your test tube and do it again in the laboratory. This is historical evidence about things that we know from witnesses who were there. So a couple of years ago, I was talking at school yesterday, and I was doing a talk about stuff, and everyone was tuning out, and I said to them about halfway through, 2 years ago I was arrested just around the corner from my church, and suddenly I've got everyone's attention tonight. I got arrested. It was rather unpleasant, actually. I'd been assaulted by a guy in a white van. I was on my bike. It's quite scary. Somebody arrived, called the police. The police arrived. They said, "What's going on here?" And I said, "I've been assaulted." And the van driver said, "I've been assaulted." So they arrested both of us, took us down to the police station. And then I was released about half an hour later, and he went to trial and was convicted because there were witnesses there who saw what happened. There was no scientific evidence. There wasn't, you know, the magistrate didn't say, "Punch him again and we'll watch and see if we can repeat it." Fortunately. It's just not that kind of evidence. But actually, in the country that we live in, the evidence on the basis of reliable witnesses is sufficient to shut someone up for life imprisonment. He wasn't sent down for life, but, you know, it would be. So eyewitness evidence is very powerful. Of course, sometimes people complain, well, of course, the trouble with this stuff is it is written by people who believe it, so they were biased. And sometimes I cheekily say, yeah, like physics textbooks were written by physicists, because people only write things that they believe in, otherwise they wouldn't bother to write them. History books are written by historians, physics textbooks are written by physicists, and Christian testimony is written by Christians. The question isn't, did the people who wrote it believe it? The question is, did they have good reason to believe it? And I find that very convincing, because actually many of the writers of the New Testament were themselves eyewitnesses of the things that they describe, and so they were in a position to know whether or not it was true. This is a little logical step that helps me a lot. People sometimes die for causes that are untrue. I believe the cause of the suicide bombers who flew aircraft into the World Trade Center, I believe their cause was untrue. But they died for it because they believed it. So people will die for untrue causes, but people won't die for causes that they know are untrue. And the crucial step is, in the case of the New Testament, the people who were persecuted and died for it were the same as the people who would have known if it was untrue. I think they were convinced that these are the things they heard and saw, and if these are the things that they heard and saw, then they convinced me based on their eyewitness evidence.
Thank you. And carrying on that issue really, Andrew, so Jesus being resurrected is definitely an anomalous result. That's quite a nice scientific way of putting it. Couple of questions about the resurrection. Can you elaborate on the evidence for the historicity of the resurrection if you're saying that's the place we need to look?
Yeah. I mean, it is an anomalous result, and it needs to be miraculously significant. So let's imagine that one in three people who dies resuscitates again spontaneously after 3 days. Well, then you'd rewrite the medical textbook, and death would actually be a sort of two-thirds probability thing. Well, he's dead for now, you'd say. And you probably wait a couple of days to see what happens. But it's only precisely because people never ever come back from the dead that when somebody does, it's very significant, because it's exceptional. Now, people sometimes say to me, oh look, people in the first century were so credulous, you know, they didn't understand science, they were gullible, they'd believe anything. But I want to suggest to you that people in the first century did know that you don't come back from the dead, because they just had to see people die and notice it was a pattern, right? Just as fishermen in the first century did know that you can't walk on water. They might not have been able to describe it in terms of density and displacement or whatever, but they were fishermen. They knew if you got out of your boat, you sink. And here's the guy who got out of the boat and didn't sink, and that's unusual, to say the least. So they detect the extraordinary exceptions, and they draw the conclusion, we must be dealing with someone altogether exceptional. This has never ever happened before. Well, actually, that's an understatement. They're basically terrified, mostly, which is, I would suggest, exactly how you would be if you went to a funeral and then a week later you met the person who you'd buried. It's terrifying. But what kind of evidence is it? People met him. Lots of people met him on different occasions. It wasn't just one dream by a wishful thinking disciple. They ate with him, and the food that he ate disappeared. It wasn't, you know, just like a floaty ghosty thing. They touched him. You remember famously Doubting Thomas said, I can't believe that he's back from the dead unless I put my hands in the marks where they crucified him. And people call him Doubting Thomas. I want to call him Rational Thomas, because that's a pretty good argument. And Jesus appears to him and says, check. And so he physically checks. And so they are convinced on the basis of a physical encounter, or several physical encounters, with the Jesus who 2 days ago they'd seen be executed, that he got through death. Which explains why they were willing to be martyred for it. They were absolutely convinced that he could get them through death as well.
Thank you. I'm going to make this the final question, just for the sake of time. And Andrew, I think lots of the things you've said speak to this, but just by way of wrap up, there were a couple of questions on this. So science doesn't contradict God, but how does it mean that the God is the God of Christianity? So, and a couple of other questions on how do we now compare to other religions?
Okay, sure. So I've been trying to argue for most of this talk that I think the idea that the universe created itself by chance is a really very problematic theory. That's what the atheist says, and actually it flies in the face of all the science. So atheism does not have science on its side, I'm arguing. Whereas all of science points to an intelligence who chooses the numbers, who makes the human beings, and who has a purpose for the universe. But for most of what I said, I haven't distinguished between, say, Christianity and Islam. In fact, I did this talk at a university recently, and a couple of Muslims came, and they were happy for the most part in what I said, until I got to the bit about Jesus at the very end. But really, Jesus is the key to what God is like. Remember I said, so supposing you wanted to get to know somebody, science couldn't help you, you'd have to meet them and encounter them. And the Christian claim is that 2,000 years ago, God became a human being. He did miracles to authenticate himself, he rose from the dead. And so now we know what God is like, because God is like Jesus, because Jesus is God. And so if you wanted to decide between the world's religions, I would say begin with Jesus. You could begin with Muhammad, or you could begin with the Buddha, but the trouble with something like Islam or Buddhism is it's difficult to falsify. There's another scientific category. Because Muhammad says that he met the angel Gabriel in a cave on his own and transcribed what he was told. But I want to say, how can I check that? Just got your word for it. And as it happens, I don't believe that he met an angel. I think he just wrote it down from his own head. But with Jesus, at least you can check. There are historical sources, people he met, things he did, things were all witnessed. So start there. And if Christianity ends up being falsified, you tick one off your list, you can look for the next one down. Then you look at Islam or Buddhism or whatever. But if you look at Jesus and you get convinced, no, he can only have been God who made the world, well, then your quest is over and you found the truth.
Andrew, thank you. I mean, we've covered an amazing amount of ground, haven't we, in a very short space of time. Thank you. Thank you guys for the questions. Thank you for coming.